to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. This KBU program has been made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946. With service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. The music you were listening to was Wayne Shorter, and the album was Speak No Evil, with Herbie Hancock on keys, Elvin Bishop on drums, and Ron Carter on bass. And now, Occupy Radio.
On Thursday, November 21st, KBOO is proud to co-sponsor a discussion on racism and settler colonialism at home and abroad, a conversation toward building global solidarity. Student speakers will explore and counter the master narratives that deny our histories and our rights, from the European conquest of the Americas and the enslavement of Africans to the ongoing colonialism of Palestine. Settler colonialism has promoted racism and obstructed the self-determination of indigenous communities. The event will take place on Thursday, November 21st at 6:30 at the Native American Student and Community Center at Portland State University.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
It's about time.
12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Portland Radio for 90th. I'm Jimmy Tardy. Russia and for All Saints Cathedral Mosque of Letters between her and Slav Philosopher State Universe. Strategic thing and social. We'll hear a speech, a Seattle soul member, Shamus, a year of some music from Corey Anderson. He an expert. Also here, come to the
only an expert can deal with the problem. Because half the problem is seeing a problem. And only an expert can deal with the problem. An expert with the problem. So if there's no expert dealing with the problem, it's really actually twice the problem. Because only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem. Now in America, we like solutions. We like solutions to problems. And there's so many companies that offer solutions. Companies with names like the pet solution, the hair solution, the debt solution, the petroleum solution, the solution. Experts ready to solve these problems. Because only an expert can see there's a problem, and only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem.
So only an expert can deal with the problem, and only an expert can deal with the problem, and only an expert can deal with the problem.
Now let's say you want to be on Oprah, but you don't have a problem, but you want to go on the show. So you need a problem to invent a problem. But if you're not an expert in problems, you're probably not going to make up a very plausible problem. Probably going to get nailed. You're going to get exposed. And you're going to have to bow down and apologize and beg for the public's forgiveness.
Because only an expert can deal with the problem. And only an expert can deal with the problem. And only an expert can deal with the problem.
Sometimes, when the oil drill breaks, and the oil spills out into the ocean, and it poisons the fish, and it destroys the whole coastline. And they bring in the riggers, and they bring in the experts, and they can't cap it, and they can't stop it, and oil keeps spilling, and every duck and every dolphin is completely coated with oil. And everyone knows it's a problem. So when experts say, let's get to the root of the problem, let's take control of the problem, because if you take control of the problem, you can solve the problem. Now often this doesn't work at all, because the situation is completely out of control.
Who's calling an expert can deal with the problem? Only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem.
Only an expert can see there's a problem, and seeing the problem is half the problem. And only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert the problem.
Exchange boy Z January is your life around that you have are my thought articles. Really, all the else change. Indifference to the fatality lack of humanery leaves the tuning for the nose is a G flaption of the performances. In spite of all accusations, secretly they know you even more performances so vile only in all hearts long as you the liberals the ethic visible between Stalinism. Since the two crisis developing ground, this distrust is justified. If only in Western and less wonder their message is that. Welcome to Occupy Portland Radio for November 20th, 2013. I'm Jimmy Tardy. Today's show, we will be hearing from Nadia Tolokonikova, who is a member of Pussy Riot, who's been jailed in Russia for hooliganism. She received a 2-year sentence for a punk prayer that was held at All Saints Cathedral in Moscow. An exchange of letters between her and Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek. We'll talk with Professor Bob Liebman of Portland State University about Bill Moyer's movement action plan, how it relates to strategic thinking in social movements. And we'll hear a speech given by newly elected Seattle City Council member Kashama Sawant. This is an address that she gave about a year ago. We have some music from Laurie Anderson, Only an Expert. We'll also hear a little bit of Pink Floyd, Welcome to the Machine. Let's get started.
Now only an expert can deal with the problem, because half the problem is seeing a problem. And only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem. So if there's no expert dealing with the problem, it's really actually twice the problem. Because only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem. Now in America, we like solutions. We like solutions to problems. And there's so many companies that offer solutions. Companies with names like the pet solution, the hair solution, the debt solution, the petroleum solution, the sushi solution. Companies with experts ready to solve these problems. Because only an expert can see there's a problem, and only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem.
So only an expert can deal with the problem, and only an expert can deal with the problem.
Now let's say you want to be on Oprah, but you don't have a problem. But you want to go on the show, so you need a problem. So you invent a problem. But if you're not an expert in problems, you're probably not going to make up a very plausible problem. So you're probably going to get nailed. You're going to get exposed. And you're going to have to bow down and apologize and beg for the public's forgiveness. Cause only an expert can deal with the problem, and only an expert can deal with the problem, and only an expert can deal with the problem. And sometimes, when the oil drill breaks, and the oil spills out into the ocean, and it poisons the fish, and it destroys the whole coastline. And they bring in the riggers, and they bring in the experts, and they can't cap it, and they can't stop it, and oil keeps spilling, and every duck and every dolphin is completely coated with oil. And everyone knows it's a problem. So when experts say, let's get to the root of the problem, let's take control of the problem, because if you take control of the problem, you can solve the problem. Now often this doesn't work at all, because the situation is completely out of control. Because only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem. Because only an expert can deal with the problem. Because only an expert can see there's a problem, and seeing the problem is half the problem. And only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem.
What follows is a reading of correspondence exchanged between Nadezhda Tolokonnikova, the jailed Pussy Riot member, and Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, 2 January 2013. Dear Nadezhda, I hope you have been able to organize your life in prison around small rituals that make it tolerable, and that you have time to read. Here are my thoughts on your predicament. John J. Chapman, an American political essayist, wrote this about radicals in 1900. Quote, they are really always saying the same thing. They don't change, everybody else changes. They are accused of the most incompatible crimes of egoism and a mania for power, indifference to the fate of their cause, fanaticism, triviality, lack of humor, buffoonery, and irreverence. But they sound a certain note. Hence the great political power of persistent radicals. To all appearance, nobody follows them, yet everyone believes them. They hold a tuning fork and sound A, and everybody knows it really is A, though the time-honored pitch is G-flat. Isn't this a good description of the effect of Pussy Riot performances? In spite of all accusations, you sound a certain note. It may appear that people do not follow you, but secretly, they believe you. They know you are telling the truth, or even more, you are standing for truth. But what is this truth? Why are the reactions to Pussy Riot performances so violent, not only in Russia? All hearts were beating for you as long as you were perceived as just another version of the liberal democratic protest against the authoritarian state. The moment it became clear that you rejected global capitalism, reporting on Pussy Riot became much more ambiguous. What is so disturbing about Pussy Riot to the liberal gaze is that you make visible the hidden continuity between Stalinism and contemporary global capitalism. Since the 2008 crisis, this distrust of democracy, once limited to third world or post-communist developing economies, is gaining ground in Western cultures. But what if this distrust is justified? What if only experts can save us? But the crisis provided proof that is these experts who don't know what they are doing rather than the people. In Western Europe, we are seeing that the ruling elite know less and less how to rule. Look at how Europe is dealing with Greece. No wonder, then, that Pussy Riot makes us all uneasy. You know very well what you don't know, and you don't pretend to have any quick or easy answers, but you are telling us that those in power don't know either. Your message is that in Europe today, the blind are leading the blind. That is why it is so important that you persist. In the same way that Hegel, after seeing Napoleon riding through Jena, wrote that it was as if he saw the world spirit riding on a horse. You are nothing less than the critical awareness of us all sitting in prison. Comradely greetings, Slavoj.
23rd of February, 2013. Dear Slavoj, once in the autumn of 2012, when I was still in the pre-trial prison in Moscow with other Pussy Riot activists, I visited you. In a dream, of course. I see your argument about horses, the world spirit, and about tomfoolery and disrespect, as well as why and how all of these elements are so connected to each other. Pussy Riot did turn out to be part of this force, the purpose of which is criticism, creativity, and co-creation, experimentation, and constantly provocative events. Borrowing Nietzsche's definition, we are the children of Dionysus, sailing in a barrel and not recognizing any authority. We are a part of this force that has no final answers or absolute truths, for our mission is to question. There are architects of Apollonian statics, and there are punk singers of dynamics and transformation. One is not better than the other. But it is only together that we can ensure the world functions in the way that Heraclitus defined it. This world has been and will eternally be living on the rhythm of fire, inflaming according to measure and dying away according to the measure. This is the function of the eternal world breath. We are the rebels asking for the storm and believing that truth is only to be found in the endless search. If the quote-unquote world spirit touches you, do not expect that it will be painless. Laurie Anderson sang, "Only an expert can deal with a problem." It would have been nice if Laurie and I could have cut these experts down to size and taken care of our own problems, because expert status by no means grants access to the kingdom of absolute truth. 2 years of prison for Pussy Riot is our tribute to a destiny that gave us sharp ears, allowing us to sound a note A when everyone else is used to hearing G flat. At the right moment, there will always come a miracle in the lives of those who childishly believe in the triumph of truth over lies, of mutual assistance, of those who live according to the economics of the gift. Nadia.
For April 2013. Dear Nadezhda, I was so pleasantly surprised when your letter arrived. The delay made me fear that the authorities would prevent our communication. I was deeply honored, flattered even, by my appearance in your dream. You are right to question the idea that the experts close to power are competent to make decisions. Experts are, by definition, servants of those in power. They don't really think, they just apply their knowledge to the problem defined by those in power. How to bring back stability, how to squash protests. So are today's capitalists, the so-called financial wizards, really experts? Are they not just stupid babies playing with our money and our fate? I remember a cruel joke from Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be. When asked about the German concentration camps in occupied Poland, the Nazi officer snaps back, "We do the concentrating and the Poles do the camping." Does the same not hold for the Enron bankruptcy in 2002? The thousands of employees who lost their jobs were certainly exposed to risk, but with no true choice. For them, the risk was like blind fate. But those who did have insight into the risks and the ability to intervene, the top managers, minimized their risk by cashing in their stocks before the bankruptcy. So it is true that we live in a society of risky choices, but some people, the managers, do the choosing, while others, the common people, do the risking. For me, the true task of radical emancipatory movements is not just to shake things out of their complacent inertia, but to change the very coordinates of that social reality so that when things return to normal, there will be a new, more satisfying Apollonian statics. And even more crucially, how does today's global capitalism enter this scheme? The Deleuzian philosopher Brian Massumi tells how capitalism has already overcome the logic of totalizing normality and adopted the logic of erratic excess. Quote, "The more varied and even erratic, the better. normality starts to lose its hold. The regularities start to loosen. This loosening is part of capitalism's dynamic. But I feel guilty writing this. Who am I to explode in such narcissistic theoretical outbursts when you are exposed to very real deprivations? So please, if you can and want, do let me know about your situation in prison, your daily rhythm, about the little private rituals that make it easier to survive, about how much time you have to read and write, about how other prisoners and guards treat you, about your contact with your child. True heroism resides in these seemingly small ways of organizing one's life in order to survive in crazy times without losing dignity. With love, respect, and admiration, my thoughts are with you. Slavoj.
16th of April, 2013. Dear Slavoj, has modern capitalism really overtaken the logic of totalizing norms, or is it willing to make us believe that it has overpassed the logic of hierarchical structures and normalization? As a child, I wanted to go into advertising. I had a love affair with the advertising industry, and this is why I'm in a position to judge its merits. The anti-hierarchical structures and rhizomes of late capitalism are its successful ad campaign. Modern capitalism has to manifest itself as flexible and even eccentric. Everything is geared towards gripping the emotion of the consumer. Modern capitalism seeks to assure us that it operates according to the principles of free creativity, endless development, and diversity. It glosses over its other side in order to hide the reality that millions of people are enslaved by an all-powerful and fantastically stable norm of production. We want to reveal this lie. You should not worry that you are exposing theoretical fabrications while I am supposed to suffer the quote-unquote real hardship. I value the strict limits and the challenge. I am genuinely curious, how will I cope with this? And how can I turn this into a productive experience for me and my comrades? I find sources of inspiration. It contributes to my own development, not because of, but in spite of the system. And in my struggle, your thoughts, ideas, and stories are helpful to me. I am happy to correspond with you. I await your reply, and I wish you good luck in our common cause. Nadia.
10 June 2013. Dear Nadezhda, I felt deeply ashamed after reading your reply. You wrote, quote, "You should not worry about the fact that you are exposing theoretical fabrications while I am supposed to suffer the real hardship." This simple sentence made me aware that the final sentiment in my last letter was false. My expression of sympathy with your plight basically meant, quote, "I have the privilege of doing real theory and teaching you about it, while you are good for reporting on your experience of hardship. Your last letter demonstrates that you are much more than that, that you are an equal partner in a theoretical dialogue. So my sincere apologies for this proof of how deeply entrenched is male chauvinism, especially when it is masked as sympathy for the other's suffering. And let me go on with our dialogue. It is the crazy dynamics of global capitalism that make effective resistance to it so difficult and frustrating. Recall the great wave of protest that spilled all over Europe in 2011 from Greece and Spain to London and Paris. Even if there was no consistent political platform mobilizing the protesters, the protests function as part of a large-scale educational process. The protesters' misery and discontent were transformed into a great collective act of mobilization. Hundreds of thousands gathered in public squares proclaiming that they had enough, that things could not go on like that. However, what these protests add up to is a purely negative gesture of angry rejection and an equally abstract demand for justice, lacking the ability to translate this demand into a concrete political program. What can be done in such a situation where demonstrations and protests are of no use, where democratic elections are of no use? Can we convince the tired and manipulated crowds that we are not only ready to undermine the existing order, to engage in provocative acts of resistance, but also to offer the prospect of a new order? The Pussy Riot performances cannot be reduced just to subversive provocations. Beneath the dynamics of their acts, there is the inner stability of a firm ethico-political attitude. In some deeper sense, it is today's society that is caught in a crazy capitalist dynamic with no inner sense and measure, and it is Pussy Riot that de facto provides a stable ethico-political point. The very existence of Pussy Riot tells thousands that opportunist cynicism is not the only option, that we are not totally disoriented, that there still is a common cause worth fighting for. So I wish you good luck in our common cause. To be faithful to our common cause means to be brave, especially now, and, as the old saying goes, luck is on the side of the brave. Yours, Slavoj.
13th of July, 2013. Dear Slavoj, in my last letter written in haste as I worked in the sewing shop, I was not as clear as I should have been about the distinction between how quote-unquote global capitalism functions in Europe and the U.S. on the one hand, and how Russia on the other. However, recent events in Russia, the trial of Alexei Navalny, the passing of unconstitutional anti-freedom laws, have infuriated me. I feel compelled to speak about the specific political and economic practices of my country. The last time I felt this angry was in 2011 when Putin declared he was running for the presidency for a third time. My anger and resolve led to the birth of Pussy Riot. What will happen now? Time will tell. Here in Russia, I have a strong sense of the cynicism of so-called first world countries toward poorer nations. In my humble opinion, quote-unquote developed countries display an exaggerated loyalty towards governments that oppress their citizens and violate their rights. The European and U.S. governments freely collaborate with Russia as it imposes laws from the Middle Ages and throws opposition politicians in jail. They collaborate with China, where oppression is so bad my hair stands on end just to think about it. What are the limits of tolerance? And when does tolerance become collaboration, conformism, and complicity? To think, cynically, quote-unquote, let them do what they want in their own country, doesn't work any longer, because Russia and China and countries like them are now a part of the global capitalist system. Russia under Putin, with its dependence on raw materials, would have been massively weakened if those nations that import Russian oil and gas had shown the courage of their convictions and stopped buying. Even if Europe were to take as modest a step as passing the Magnitsky Law, the Magnitsky Act in the U.S. allows it to place sanctions on Russian officials believed to have taken part in human rights violations. Morally, it would speak volumes. A boycott of the Sochi Winter Olympics in 2014 would be another ethical gesture. But the continued trade in raw materials constitutes a tacit approval of the Russian regime. But the continued trade in raw materials constitutes a tacit approval of the Russian regime, not through words, but through money. It betrays the desire to protect the political and economic status quo and the division of labor that lies at the heart of the world economic system. You quote Marx, a social system that seizes up and rusts cannot survive. But here I am, working out my prison sentence in a country where 10 people who control the biggest sectors of the economy are Vladimir Putin's oldest friends. He studied or played sports with some and served in the KGB with others. Isn't this a social system that has seized up? Isn't this a feudal system? I thank you sincerely, Slavoj, for our correspondence and can hardly wait for your reply. Yours, Nadia.
That was a reading of correspondence exchanged between Nadezhda Tolokonikova, the jailed Pussy Riot member, and Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek. The correspondence was organized by Philosophy Magazine in cooperation with New Times. Longer versions can be found in German at philomag.de or in French at philomag.com. Tolokonikova's letters were translated from Russian by Galia Ackerman.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Professor Robert Liebman. He's a professor of sociology and urban studies and planning at PSU. He invited some of our local Occupy Portland members into his classroom to speak with his students a couple of terms ago about Occupy Portland and their experiences. He's been a longtime student and professor of comparative social institutions, historical sociology, and social change. And he's also covering the areas of communities and organizations and religion. All of those things make him a unique observer and commentator on the Movement Action Plan, which we're talking about, developed by Bill Moyer. Movement Action Plan is a framework through which to view and analyze social movements on a strategic level. Thanks for being here, Bob. We're talking about the Movement Action Plan and comparing it to where the Occupy movement sits at this point historically. And the reason that I'm talking about that now is because we recently had a visit from Elliot Adams, who is a former national president of Veterans for Peace. He was in town talking about the Movement Action Plan. And in that discussion, we talked about how there has been some perhaps feelings of defeat among people who were associated with the Occupy movement in general. But then just this weekend, we got word that Kashama Sawant was elected to the Seattle City Council. And she is a member of Occupy Seattle and an avowed socialist. Bob, what do you think about how the Movement Action Plan informs us at this point in history with regard to Occupy?
Well, I'm going to have to say that I think there's a different road for the Movement Action Plan and Occupy. The Movement Action Plan is much more issue-oriented, so it imagines there are a bunch of people who share an orientation to something like the dangers of nuclear power or Southern civil rights or other things that can be targeted in a single campaign. And by contrast, I think Occupy asked bigger questions about whether, in lieu of a campaign, you want to have a more cultural target and look at the values by which the society runs to create inequality, to disempower people by excluding them from the media, to disenfranchise them by making their votes count less than big dollars. So for me, one is really a great instrument if you want to go after a focused goal. The other one is to take on the whole apparatus of climate change, capitalism, and political immobility in the United States. And so they're working off each other, but they're on a really different plane.
Sure. I would have to say from my experience that there has been a lot of fracturing among people associated with the Occupy movement, and we're still maybe trying to find our feet in regard to what exactly it is that we're addressing.
That's a great point. I think one difference is that in the MAP framework, it's thought that there are people who are on board, and of course, the stages, which are at the heart of MAP, you move through these steps in order to build a social movement. And their stages include the idea of educating, mobilizing, so you build knowledge, you build connections. But more at the center of MAP is this idea there's a trigger event that crystallizes a bunch of people who find a common target. Then from there, the movement ramps up to a much higher level of action. So in Occupy's case, I don't know there was so much a trigger event. I think that Occupy is one of many movements that tries to run off past examples. And so ahead of Occupy were things like the Arab Spring Tahrir Square movements. And there was the whole contest in the state capital of Wisconsin. I mean, the year 2011 had all these explosions, with some of them which were occupations, like the occupation of the state capitol. And so Occupy, I think, followed in a chain of these moments where you have a massive gathering of people And I don't know that they actually have the forward look that the Movement Action Plan is. The Movement Action Plan is a plan. Occupy had lots of vision and a lot of energy, but I don't think it really had a concrete plan to which people were directed when they joined occupations. I could talk more about, you know, what's going on in the aftermath of Occupy, one piece of which is this victory in the Seattle City Council. But tell me where to go, and I'll go as you wish.
Maybe perhaps stepping away from the notion of whether Occupy was, I suppose, had a crystal clear target. I think another thing that it's important to recognize that the Movement Action Plan kind of lays out is that there's four different sort of, I guess, roles of activists within social movements that I think definitely still apply and are obvious to me when they're laid out by Mr. Moyer. And he talks about the citizen, the reformer, the rebel, and the change agent, and how each of these roles is kind of directed at a different aspect of civil society and sort of challenging the, I guess, psychological status quo. So, for instance, the citizen promotes positive national values and symbols, whereas a reformer is kind of trying to work within the system. The rebel is kind of saying, hey, the system isn't working, and maybe we need to directly risk our own skin in order to address the issue. And then the change agent is somebody who's kind of stepping back on a more strategic level and trying to develop larger structures in which to keep the momentum moving forward. How do you see those roles playing out over the past couple of years, and what do you think about the Movement Action Plan as far as those four roles?
Oh, I think it's actually very useful. I mean, for one, part of the problem of Occupy is that it had put all the players on the stage, but it didn't really have a script for the players to follow, and it didn't have stage directions for the players to actually carry on the presentation. So what Moyer is good at, coming out of the tradition of nonviolent protest from the civil rights movement and then his role in nuclear energy, is he really wants to figure out how people can be tasked so that they develop coordinated action and take different roles within a social movement. And he's got some ideas about, you know, which people should be in the front of each movement, and he recognizes that things move in different directions depending on who leads them. So, yeah, I think that's a really big question about a leader-led movement. And he comes out of a tradition in which many of the people who started the movement were local leaders. They led congregations. They led organizations like NAACP. And so they had congregations and they had associations, and they sort of built these people into a coalition. And then he moves into something like nuclear energy, which I think is closer to the world that you described for Occupy, where people didn't have membership or kind of all came together. And so, you know, I think MAP is a really good question. I think where you're pushing is, how do you take the energy, how do you take the passion and principle of Occupy and direct it toward programs of change that really push the things that Occupy tried to target in its messages? It had a lot of messages. It didn't have so many orders for mobilization to crystallize people into long campaigns. A lot of things launched on the ground during the occupation, including protests over banks and protests in alliance with labor, immigrant groups, this and that. But it didn't really have, like Moyer suggests, a long set of steps to move toward building a full-fledged movement.
Right. Something that I found interesting as I learned more about the MAP was the fact that as time goes on, those four roles, as you move through the eight stages, those four roles have different relative levels of activity. And so, for instance, you were mentioning that trigger event, which is kind of when something really kind of pops up on the radar and people are aware of it. It's called takeoff, which right. The Occupy movement is obviously has a very distinct trigger event and takeoff as far as in this country, conditions were sort of set and then the occupations of public spaces happened. And in that stage was when the rebel role became very predominant in that people were standing and just simply being civilly disobedient and saying no. But then as time goes on, with Moyer's framework and examining historically how things have gone, as time goes on, the active citizen is now, you know, stepping in and becoming more involved and sort of picking up where now the rebels who have stood up and said no, maybe they're feeling a little bit of burnout, because I know from personal experience that that can be a very draining role to be part of. So now the active citizen, maybe they have a little bit more resources emotionally, physically, psychologically, and they're sort of taking a little slower approach to it, and they're ramping up as time goes on. And then also the change agents are coming along and sort of catching catching the wave that's being generated as far as social energy and attention, and people are sort of working together in these roles in order to keep things moving in a certain direction. And I think for pretty much anybody who's new to social activism, who's new to civil disobedience, who's new to the level of intensity that the Occupy movement has shown itself to have, I think it's good to look at this movement action plan and see how it is that things can work together and people can be in completely separate roles and perhaps have a different viewpoint or a different approach, but understand that they are working together on the larger scale and to kind of use that maybe to re-energize themselves.
Right. And I think your example of the city council victory by Kashama Sawant fits into that. I mean, here's somebody who was active in Occupy and moved into party work and ran unsuccessfully, I think, for state office.
Right.
And then next year went out and ran for the city council, but did all the shoe leather campaigning of going to meetings and living rooms and managed to eke out this victory of just over 50% against somebody who was a long-time incumbent. That so it was always a much bigger deal.
Right.
But, I think the nice thing about your framework is that people, depending on where they sit and their own inclination, can be better at handling some of these roles. So in her case, she kind of moved from being part of the initial Occupy explosion into focusing much more on doing citizen work and building up a base of support, moving into a political forum. And then maybe after that, she can switch into the role of change agent. I mean, she's got a platform and access to resources, so it's a big deal. I read the coverage in the newspaper where they reported the story and then followed up with comments, and a lot of people said, oh, her program is to change the economy of Seattle and the city council can't do it. But I'm not so sure, and I just want to speak on her behalf. One, the city council has a role in setting wage and hours laws, as you saw, for example, in fair wage campaigns, including Portland and Seattle. In addition, the city councils in Seattle and Portland recently passed sick leave for people who are in jobs where it's not normally offered. And then there are also anti-discrimination policies where the city council decides who gets the contracts. And so I'd say, you know, the other thing, of course, that's really important, back to your point about movement formation, is the city council also has a role to play in police, in parade permits, in support for demonstrations. The city council of Portland let people occupy Chapman Park. And so all power to her. I mean, I think that your point is that one of the real skills that comes out of the Movement Action Plan is to know the circumstances, to understand which roles are possible, and then for people to have that script to know how to play the role effectively.
Yeah, and to understand that other people may be doing other roles and to maybe just get a sense of maybe this is the time for people to stand and make some noise and sort of present the quote-unquote ugly side of things. And then as we sort of assimilate that information and decide as a group, yes, we need to address that. Now let's continue that discussion and move forward and sort of see where that goes. And even, you know, accept the fact that, say, for instance, the squatters who were occupying foreclosed homes, while you may think that is something of a drastic move, that is actually playing into the overall story, and it is contributing its part to the conversation, and that is actually a valuable role and activity for someone to engage in that they are continuing to challenge not only the power structure's assumptions, but our assumptions as members of the society, and that's healthy for us.
Right. And in that way, I think one important role of the rebels is to win attention, and the occupation of houses was a way to carry on some of the conversation about the themes that the Portland occupation raised. Why are people being foreclosed? Why isn't there a workout for their debt, as there is for the debt of the city of Detroit? Or, you know, I mean, it really forced, by personalizing the struggle, attention on the bigger machinery of capitalism in the United States.
I've been speaking with Professor Robert Liebman. He is professor of sociology and urban studies and planning at PSU, and was hosting some Occupy activists in his classroom a couple of terms ago at PSU. And we've been talking about the Movement Action Plan.
Hi, everyone. It's great to see everyone here. My name is Rami Khalil. I'm from Socialist Alternative, and it is my honor to introduce Kshama Sawant to you tonight. Kshama is an economics professor at Seattle Central Community College. She's also been a teacher at Seattle University, And she's a member, therefore, of the, well, at least at Seattle Central Community College, of the union there, the American Federation of Teachers, Local 1789. She comes out of the Occupy Wall Street movement, and she's a tremendous fighter for the interests of workers, women, people of color, LGBTQ people. And it's my honor and pleasure to introduce you to her tonight. So please join me in welcoming her.
Mic check. Thank you, Rami, for that very generous introduction. I will try to live up to that expectation. Thank you all for being here tonight. It is indeed my honor to be able to speak to you about some of the most burning and important issues of our times. And I also wanted us to recognize that we are today in historic times. You know, we have just been through the Arab Spring with the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions. We've been through the Wisconsin uprising and the Occupy movement, which finally, after so many decades, broke the silence on the deep inequality that pervades our society, the corporate domination, the financial oligarchy, the rapaciousness and greed with which corporations have been looting not only this country, but this entire planet. So we are indeed... So we are indeed fortunate, I think, to be part of this struggle. It's indeed, an honor to be fighting for our fellow human beings and for our brothers and sisters. And I wanted to start by saying that, you know, we are here in a gathering of third-party candidates. So let's recognize what that really implies. So if we are living in an era of struggle of the Occupy movement, we are in an era where we are facing the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. We are facing deep inequality and poverty. And we are also in an era when people are refusing to accept the status quo. We are seeing students rising up everywhere. We are also seeing young people recognizing that they don't have much of a future. They're facing a bleak future with this double whammy of very few job prospects and a ball and chain of student debt that is going to be around their neck for the rest of their lives. And in such an era, if a party that has been around for decades and decades and claims to represent the progressive agenda and claims to represent the working class, if such a party is not able to sweep the floor in the elections against a robber baron, Mr. 1% buffoon venture capitalist, then they have themselves to blame. We are not the spoilers, they are. And the fact that Obama is running neck to neck with Romney and is not able to surge ahead decisively is a testament to the betrayal after betrayal after betrayal of the Democratic Party. And it's no different here. I mean, we're running a state race, but it's no different here. And in fact, I would say that we have a stronger case to indict the role of the Democratic Party because they have been in the majority. They have held the governor's mansion for well over a decade. And look at what they have given us. They have given us massive cuts to higher education, all the almost decimation of basic health and the disability lifeline. And they're telling us that, you know what, we need to do these things. Chop, our opponent, Frank Chop, who is the Speaker of the House, is often going on the campaign trail saying, you know, he stood next to me several times and said that I have saved basic health. That means that I have pulled out a few crumbs for you lesser mortals while I am fulfilling my real agenda, which is to be a servant to my corporate masters. And I am a teacher, so I really want to highlight what has happened to higher education. If you look at all over the state, the costs of higher education for students today now have doubled since 2006. So they're facing a really, really tough period ahead, and we have to be talking about that. And we have to explain, why is it that the Democratic Party is not able to carry out even a semblance of a fight against what's happening? And the reason is that they are so tied at the hip with corporations. Andrew, who spoke before me, you know, he talked about the coal terminal. One of the major corporations behind the coal terminal is Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad Company. Mr. Chop has received $900 in the current campaign from this corporation. But that is just one really tiny grain of sand in the ocean of evidence that you can see that if a party is taking corporate money, then they are going to be beholden to that corporate agenda. And the sooner we wake up to that reality, the better for us. Our campaign is calling for free, good quality public education from K through 12 through university. We're calling for single payer health care. We don't want Obamacare, which the physicians for a national health plan have called an aspirin to cure cancer. We want single payer health care. And we know it can be done. I mean, whenever we talk about this, the Democrats will tell us that, you know, you guys are dreamers. You don't know how it is to live in the real world. You know, in the real world, you have to actually get things done. You know, have you ever heard this phrase? You know, you have to get things done. What they mean by getting things done is getting things done for the corporations and selling us down the river. So we have to reject that logic. We're saying that education and healthcare and all the social needs can be fully funded in a high-quality manner. There is a lot of wealth in this state. This state is actually awash in wealth. Microsoft alone made $23 billion in profit last year in 2011. So we are calling for all these programs to be funded by taxing the rich. Tax the super rich, tax the big corporations, tax all those entities who have been bleeding us dry for all these decades. We're the ones doing all the work, they take all the profit, and we have to say enough to that whole idea. But you know, the moment you say that, the Democrats and other people will say, well, you know, if you tax the rich, they're the job creators. They're going to leave the state. What are you going to do then? Well, I will say, just as an economist, that there is plenty of evidence that they don't actually create jobs. The way jobs are created under capitalism is by consumption, by ordinary people like you and me. That is what creates jobs. However, there is some truth to the fact that if the rich face higher costs, then they will try to move their, move themselves elsewhere, because that is the logic of global capitalism. And that is why I am a socialist, because you have to recognize that as long as there is another source of labor that is even more desperate than us, and so they're willing to take on lower wages than us, it doesn't matter whether it's South Carolina or the Philippines. As long as there is that other source of surplus labor, jobs can move, and if they can, they will move. That is the logic. But follow the logic to its end. If you accept that, then what are you facing? You're facing a global and a national race to the bottom. So you have the governments of all these 50 states fighting not to improve your standard of living and to make sure your kids get good education and health care, but to see which of us can come out ahead in providing the best conditions for profit making for big corporations. And so we're saying, no, we reject those parameters of capitalism. If